A little bit on Monday about the criticism of the Bible. Interestingly, I was just reading an article this morning online that appeared in the Guardian newspaper out of Great Britain Monday. There's a museum that is opening up in Washington, D.C. called the Bible Museum. Any of you heard about that, familiar with that? The owner of Hobby Lobby, you all know what Hobby Lobby is, multi-gazillionaire. Hobby Lobby is actually, they are the ones who bought the old Ambassador College property, Worldwide Church of God Ambassador College property in Big Sandy, Texas. They bought that and they own that now. Anyway, the billionaire owner has funded the building of a museum right in downtown Washington called the Bible Museum. And it's devoted to bringing people, you know, into a greater awareness about the Bible and everything from the different translations to the impact culturally and socially of the Bible through the years. It's quite a, should be a very nice museum. I've seen a little bit of a video of it some months back, but it opens next month, and it would be, I'd like to go out and see it. It would be worth the trip, or if you were going to be there. But the article was taking a very negative approach to it because, number one, it's so close to the seat of American power in Washington, D.C., and here's this Bible-based organization or museum, and horrors they might influence and or resurrect evangelical influence in politics and influence lawmakers. Fat chance of that in some cases, but this was the line of approach of the article. And they were making a connection with this Bible Museum to the Creation Museum down here in Kentucky across the river, and the Ark exhibit, which is on further down in Kentucky, that, you know, in terms of just this encroachment into American culture and the idea that people would believe the Bible. That was the whole approach of the article. And as it was trying to explain what it would take, and I guess Vice President Pence is going to be a keynote speaker at the kickoff opening of it next month, and so he's an evangelical, and the great fear that evangelicalism would make another comeback in its influence into American politics, which is another story in itself. But the whole approach of the article was, again, to tear down the Bible, and who would believe in the Bible in today's modern society? And that's what the museum is dedicated to. So the Hobby Lobby people, of course, if you try to go to Hobby Lobby on Sunday, you will note that they're closed. So at least though we don't keep Sunday, I will respect their commitment to their belief that they will close their doors like Chick-fil-A does on Sundays as well. But they put a lot of money into this Bible museum. But the general thrust of society and culture today, at least the dominating political media culture, is to tear down anything about the Bible, question through articles in the media whether you can trust the Bible. In this case, this is an article actually from a magazine called Biblical Archaeology Review, which is probably it's the leading magazine out today on Bible archaeology, written for lay people, that you and I could read an article and understand it. It's not written for an academic. I think we still have a subscription to it in our library. If you do, again, it's something you ought to at least familiarize yourself. But here's an article from several years back. How reliable is Exodus, the story of the Exodus as it is told in the Bible? And again, it's the doubt that is put within the question, in this case within a magazine that is devoted to bringing news about Bible archaeology and what it is doing, what is being unearthed and discussed in that field in the world today. But everything recorded in the Bible is up for debate and possible rejection, even as continued archaeology and research unearths information, actual factual, tangible information that verifies the Bible record. Another article from that, the search for history in the Bible. History is a field that you can look to also determine the truth of the scriptures. So here's just another sampling of this from a 1997 article in Biblical Archaeology Review. And a quote here from that article: The search for history in the Bible, debate now rages over whether the 10th century kings David and Solomon, never mind Abraham and Moses, were real or merely glorious mythic figures. I touched on this on Monday, that a prevailing thought within critical biblical studies is that David and Solomon were not historical figures. They were invented by this group of nomadic people who suddenly emerged about the 10th century BC in the area that is today the state of Israel, and they invented their history, even going back to figures like Abraham and Moses. Now, when it comes to David and Solomon, we do have verifiable references from archaeological evidence that has been unearthed in Israel of David, the house of David, and references to that. And again, that is a proof, and about as good a proof as you could get to verifying that these were actual historical figures. Of course, the Jewish people have always held that their ancestor was King David and King Solomon, and that their history, as told in the Bible, is true. But critical scholarship, and as I was saying the other day, even Arab scholarship and Arab ideas would discount that, and that is an ongoing issue. But it goes to these lengths where they look at them as basically mythical figures. This quote from a biblical scholar named Philip Davies: "What separates a minimalist from a maximalist? Not much. A minimalist, in terms of they minimize the Bible. All right, their approach to the Bible is to minimize its veracity, its truth. A maximalist in this context is talking about someone who then looks to the Bible as being a true account. Now, that's could be a far cry from looking at the Bible as an authority for faith and life. So let's separate where people are, let's say, in the academic theological world as they look at the Bible. Many will look at and see that it can be looked at as a historical record. But whether or not then that is the sole guide for matters of faith and truth, as our fundamental belief says, then that's another step. That a lot of people who would study the Bible as a true book would not go so far as to accept it as the sole authority in their life. On the archaeological side, the people we may now identify as historical Israel are generally agreed to have emerged at the beginning of the Iron Age, about 1200 BCE, and to have been indigenous to Palestine. That last statement there introduces some interesting concepts. Iron Age, you don't need to worry about that, let me just expose you to it. Archaeologists, as they go back in time into the ancient world, they catalog different periods by certain names. And the Iron Age is a name that denotes a certain period of ancient history, primarily because there they find the use of iron tools and iron in life, as opposed to an earlier time where iron works and iron is not brought into the culture. So you'll see that, but don't worry about being tested on that. How many of you know what BCE refers to as it is used? Kyle, what is it? Before Common Era. Or we would say, you know, BC, before Christ. So you'll see BCE and CE for Common Era generally came into play to appease non-religious people and referring to this dividing line that is the time of the birth of Christ and the Christian period. Okay, so this is what you're dealing with here when it comes to a lot of scholarship and approach that question the validity of Scripture. Again, from BAR, the fundamental proposition of the revisionist historians can be summarized as such: that the Hebrew Bible is a product of the cultural and identity crisis of Judaism, not the story of an actual historical Israel. So these are the ideas that people have. And they conclude that the Hebrew Bible thus constitutes a literary tradition and not a historical document. So you see how the Bible is sliced and diced and truncated by scholarship, even theologians, and the world today in so many different ways, and the net effect of all of it is to deny its authority of what it says it is. Now, we haven't got into, I did put up the two scriptures, 1 Timothy 3:16, 2 Peter 1, verse 21, speaking of where the Bible speaks to its authority. All scripture is given by inspiration of God. And that the scriptures were, men were moved, prophets were moved by the Spirit to write what they did. Those are self-referencing statements, two of many that the Bible will make to establish its authority and saying what it is. A critical-minded individual is not going to accept that alone for sole proof that the Bible is a holy book or this, the only book to look to. Understand how that's going to be looked at. For our purposes and for yours as a student, as a Christian, you should be able to look at the Bible as a reliable book of that its given history is true, that what it says about itself is true, and that it can be demonstrated that there were historical figures like Abraham, Moses, David, Solomon, nation of Israel, that when it speaks on those things, we can rely that that happened, that there was a King Hezekiah, there was a Sennacherib, a king of Assyria, and these nations warred and fought, and we can demonstrate that, and you can. Beyond, we would take it obviously further that we look upon then the testimony of the New Testament about the birth, the birth, the life, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ as articles of faith. Okay? And when we go to that level, obviously we're taking the Bible to a very, very personal level. And my comments again on Monday speak to the importance of all of us building upon a foundation of reliability about the Bible as to what it says that it is and understanding it for what it is, and then adding to it the concept of faith. But people look at it as something that is a tradition that should be rejected as subversive. And the article I was referring to from the Guardian newspaper in Great Britain just two days ago, essentially, that's the mindset that they take to something like the Bible Museum that opens up in the nation's capital a few blocks away from Congress and the White House and the seat of power, and that this somehow should be looked upon as wrong or as a threat for any right-thinking person. And so the Bible is rejected as something that is subversive. The article even made the comment that the museum doesn't make any reference to the Quran or the Book of Mormon, as if it should. I mean, it's the Bible Museum, and the man put up his private money to build it. He can obviously dictate what goes in there, but if that's the stated purpose, illustrate and to highlight the story, the history, and the information, the knowledge about this book, then that's their point of view. If you pay your money to go in, and it's a free museum, by the way, they suggest a $15 donation, but the admission is free. If you go there, you should know what you know what you expect and what you will get. The fundamental propositions, again, of revisionist historians can be summarized that Bible, the biblical and ancient Israel are fictitious. They're myths created by the biblical writers. There was no early Israel as a distinct ethnic entity in ancient Palestine. And according to articles in this magazine, archaeologists and biblical scholars should now concentrate on writing the history of the Palestinian peoples, not that of some imaginary ancient Israel. Look at point number 6. You know, note Palestinian peoples and ancient Israel. If I were to ask you right now, what is he talking about Palestinian people? Who would you say? Give me an example of a Palestinian. Julia?
If you're looking for a biblical reference, it's kind of where Abraham and his fathers came from. Before they became the Israelites, they were part of Palestinian people?
Well, we could discuss that. Abraham came from further over in Mesopotamia. Yeah, but from a modern political perspective, let me insert that word. Who would you define as a Palestinian by what they're referring to today? Anybody know? What's that, Charlie?
Muslims, possibly?
Yeah, that is a political statement right there. That archaeologists and Bible scholars should concentrate on writing the history of the Palestinian. That is a political statement coming out of modern political ideology. That the land, and by the land we're talking about Israel, the Holy Land occupied today by primarily the modern state of Israel, the political state of Israel, that we should look at this in a broader context, not beyond the occupation by Israelis or the Jewish people. That there were people there before them, i.e. Muslims, and that land was usurped by the modern Jewish state. And therefore we got a problem, which is a lot of the thinking behind the political clash that goes on today in that part of the world over that land of Israel. And it goes to such lengths as to rewrite the story, deny history. As I said, the Jordanian senator who said to our church group 10 years ago in Amman, Jordan, that there was no temple on the Temple Mount. No first temple built by Solomon, no second temple rebuilt by the Jews and then embellished by King Herod. That's all fiction. For a man to say that indicates a denial of history and a political ideology that wants to deny any legitimacy to the current state of Israel and the Jewish occupation and political situation in that land. That reflects a modern way of thinking. And it filters into even how archaeologists and biblical scholars are told that they should write and look at that the history there, not some imaginary ancient Israel. One of the matters of being educated and being able to read properly is to exercise a critical thinking. I know you've been taught that, I hope, at some level of your education, to think critically about anything that you read. And you should be able to do so when it comes to what you read, what you watch, what you hear, and to be able to detect bias, particular philosophical or ideological or political bias that might be there, as well as being able to detect something that is either true or false. It's a broad subject, but they're telling scholars to do that, and I think that it's appropriate that lay people think about that as well. Any questions about anything I've said here in regard to how modern scholarship looks at the Bible and the history and the things and the peoples of the Bible? All right, let's talk then a little bit about the documentary hypothesis, which is a very fundamental, critical approach to the Old Testament, and especially the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Those in the revisionist camp generally accept the documentary hypothesis, which asserts that the Pentateuch was written by a group of four different authors from various locations in Palestine over a period of centuries, and each wrote with the goal of promoting his or her own religious views. Okay? This is opposed to the view that Moses wrote those five books, which the five books say happened. Okay? Is that true or is that false? The prevailing critical method is based on this idea of the documentary hypothesis. And the first writer that you would identify in this is what they call the writer J. And they use the J because of coming out of the word Jehovah, because as they look at the text, they find that there are places where God is referred to as Yahweh or Jehovah in the divine name. And so they see patterns and a thread through those scriptures where God is addressed like this. Therefore, they conclude That must have reflected the theological approach of one particular writer, and they call him J because they don't know who he was. Okay? So as they pull apart the text, this is what they come up with. The second writer is somebody they call E, because he used the word Elohim as the divine name. All right? And so there are portions of the text that they feel were written by a second person, anonymous, but they call him E. All right? And then there is a third author who writes a completely different book of the five, the book of Deuteronomy. And you have to admit, and you know, that as you look at Deuteronomy, it is a recapitulation of the story of Israel and the law given by Moses at the end of the 40 years before they enter into the Promised Land. But it is a different book than the previous four in its content. Therefore, the conclusion is that that's a different author writing that book. And this is how they conclude that. And then there is a fourth writer who added material of major interest to the priesthood. Okay? What book of the five would you think would be a book written by somebody who was interested in recounting information about a group of priests? Which of the five books would you think would be that book there? Nathan? Leviticus would be a good choice, because the tribe of Levi, chosen to be part of the priesthood, servants there, that is a book written with a lot of details about the sacrifices and the washings and the ceremonies dealing with the tabernacle in the wilderness. And so as critics would look at that book, well, that's a different author as well, okay? Emily, I see your hand going up.
Out of curiosity, are they getting this premise from like the writing style? Is that what it is? Like, how are they deciding?
That's part
on
of it
this?
Too. Content, writing style.
And if it's promoting his or her own religious views, how it has different religious views throughout it? Is that what it's saying?
No,
it's all the same, right?
It's just it's a critical approach. The idea that one person wrote that and existed, Moses. All right, writes this comprehensive history from creation, Genesis 1:1, all the way to the entering in the story of a group of people, and this fantastic story with men like with Noah and a boat and a flood, and Abraham who, you know, hears a voice and founds this entire family, and then that family winds up in Egypt in slavery, and then a deliverer like Moses comes and swoops them out with, you know, on the heel of plagues, and this great Red Sea parts. And, you know, these are, that can't be true, is the idea. But that one author wrote all of that, put that together, and that constitutes a legitimate history of a group of people who claim to have a unique relationship with the divine, is not acceptable to modern scholarship. A lot of this developed more than 100 years ago in Europe, Germany especially, among very intelligent, learned scholars, theologians who knew the Bible, the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Hebrew, the Greek, and developed, you know, whole schools of thought that were what is called, there's higher criticism, there's lower criticism, the field of criticism is a whole. Biblical criticism is a whole study in and of itself. This is one of the primary parts of it, and it focuses in on the five books of the Pentateuch. Okay, you've already started into the Pentateuch in your class, so is this repetition? Has Dr. Dunkel covered this? Really? Okay. All right. Let's move on then. Finally, there's a fifth individual that is involved. They called him R for redactor, who took the contributions of J, E, and D, and P and put it together into the present form. Okay, that's called a redactor, and a redaction is a final editing, putting together a previously written material into a final form, would be one way to understand the idea of a redaction. And as they approach it with these books, then somebody, they feel, at some point in the past, took all this material, these desperate, written by different individuals at different times, and then put it together into the form that we look at as the Pentateuch. And then it became an accepted body of belief among this ancient people. Daniel.
Are they only criticizing the fact that people say Moses wrote it, or the actual information, or both?
It is a direct challenge to the authorship of Moses, yes, and to the legitimacy of the primary characters like a Noah, Abraham, Moses, that they didn't exist. Okay, does that answer your question?
Yeah, I'm just wondering what else if it, because even if it was multiple writers, which obviously that's not what we think, but let's just say for mm-hmm. argument's sake that it was, how does that change the validity of what was written?
Well, it cuts off at the trunk of the tree every claim that is in there, that there was a divine creator behind the creation, and that he had periods of judgment, such as in the flood, to judge mankind, and that those things happened. It negates the truth of those things, okay? And negates then the story of the idea of a chosen people. It undermines a credibility of the Bible to be what it says it does. Because you when you come to the New Testament, you have direct statements by Jesus Christ about Moses, about the prophet Daniel, which is not, Daniel's not part of the Pentateuch, but the Old Testament scriptures, but Moses, take Moses especially, and if you chop this down at the beginning of the book, then the whole book, both Old and New Testaments, fall in terms of the reliability of what they say they are. And that's at the heart of the concept of biblical criticism. When I mentioned that it began in among German theologians in the 19th century, that's also to be understood as a part of the time in which Darwinian ideas about the evolution were published and began then to undermine the accepted Christian biblical belief at that time and of that era about the Bible. And, with that scientific theory then being put forth, then you have an attack on the Bible and what the Bible says in terms of what man is and a creative being bringing man into existence. That is undermined, while at the same time, from another point of view, the more direct undermining of the text is being done. Stephen.
I'm going to add that they also, in this whole documentary hypothesis, there are things that the actors took, whether previously unrelated documents and myths about creation and form them into the history of the people. So it's more than just on collecting known sources. We talked about some, Dr. Dunkel, about if there's a book of iterations of Adam, book of this or that. So Moses might have had written sources that he used along with God's inspiration that is different than what these people are saying from the doctrine, which is pulled together unrelated things and turned them into.
Yeah, you're saying that the redactor pulled together the unrelated items into this.
Yeah, that's their, so it's not just that this guy.
And it creates a unique work as opposed to whatever other works are referred to there. Yeah. Emily.
Would they possibly say that, like, Moses was the redactor, like that he had taken other stories and then mashed them into what he wanted them to be?
They don't say that.
Okay.
They don't say that. So the answer is no. I gave you a handout that talks a bit about Moses being the author and what he says he is. Page looks a little bit like this. It's got 7 points and then for the Old Testament. Getting a little bit ahead of myself here, but let me just hold that in abeyance here for a moment. Let's consider five possible answers to the documentary hypothesis, and that is it originates from a presupposition. All right, the presupposition being this can't be true. Or there is no God. Or there is not a God as identified by this particular book. That they also actually claim too much can't be done even by a redactor pulling all of this together with the, let's say, the integrity and the seamless story flow that matches throughout five books like that. If they were written by different people over different ages that were not connected in any way, that's quite a claim and stretches credulity in that. The documentary hypothesis is based upon differences of style, is accepted then as proof that there are five or six different authors. But one author can write with different styles, even today in modern literature, and that's an accepted form. Why couldn't that have been done even in the ancient world? One writer can produce different results. The answer to that. Internal evidence, number five, is that Christ attributed the books to Moses. In his statements, Christ did do that. Now, as I said, if you accept the documentary hypothesis and if you accept that Moses didn't write the books, then you will have to throw out the Gospels and begin to pick them apart, because Christ, by his statements, says that Moses was a real character, real individual, and he wrote the law. Okay, Moses, when Christ was talking about divorce, he said, you've heard it said, Moses allowed you to divorce, is one statement that he used to reference a discussion that he had about divorce. Christ believed Moses was a real person. All right, so if you deny that Moses was, and Moses wrote what Moses said that he wrote, then we've got a problem also with veracity of Jesus Christ and what scriptures say that he said. So you see where this goes. I would throw in the book of Daniel right now as well, and we'll talk about this as we get deeper into the book of Daniel in our studies. The idea of a man writing predictive prophecy is intolerable to a critical mind, modern scholarship. That a man could be, through a vision or a dream, revelation, any other form of revelation from God, predict what is going to happen hundreds of years in advance, as Daniel says he did, that cannot be accepted by critical scholarship. And then their answer, if they want to still keep the Bible as some type of a viable book, they put Daniel having been written several hundred years after the time that he says that he lived during the Babylonian period. Well, he must have lived during the Greek period, a few hundred years later, and he wrote the history, but he wrote it as prophecy. You follow me on that? That's the critical approach to the book of Daniel. The same, the net effect, again, is you destroy the credibility of the book and what it says that it is. And so we'll talk about Daniel a little bit more, and that we can rely on what is happening here. Mosaic authorship is a very important matter. Stephen corrected me. We put on the board Monday the book written by Thomas Paine, and we put up their Common Sense because I couldn't draw forth the name of the book. Common Sense is not the book that deals with biblical criticism written by Thomas Paine. The book is The Age of Reason. Okay? You should have corrected me on the spot, but we want to correct that. It is The Age of Reason. And everything else that I said still stands. Spend a little bit of time about Moses being the author of these first five books, because, as I said, I watched some good people, members, Ambassador College graduates, get caught up with Thomas Paine's writing a few years ago, and they just rejected the Bible and rejected a whole lot more than that, unfortunately, which is why it's important that you be familiar with these arguments and all these matters and details and be able to refute that. Apart from Bible archaeology and history, these particular direct statements out of Scripture point to the evidences of Mosaic authorship. And there are seven scriptures that are given here for the Old Testament and six out of the New Testament. Most in the New Testament being statements of Jesus Christ. In number four down there under the New Testament, out of Acts 3:22 in Romans. Though Romans is obviously the Apostle Paul. In Acts 3, I believe that's out of a sermon given by Peter, where he quotes something from Moses. The point is, the Pentateuch says that Moses wrote it. The New Testament statements here from Christ, the Apostle Paul, and Peter say that Moses wrote it. There, that's some pretty strong internal evidence to buttress that fact. Moses, to get, you know, we could go deeper into it. Probably one of the critical things that Thomas Paine brings out is Numbers 12, I think it's verse 3, where Moses wrote that the man Moses was the meekest man on the face of the earth. You know that scripture? Heard that one? Is it Numbers 12:3? Kayla, double check me on that. I don't want to have to correct this on Monday. Yes. But Numbers 12:3. The man Moses was the meekest man on the face of the earth. Thomas Paine and others have taken that to say, well, he can't write that. That's not what, if he wrote that, he's not meek. That's boasting. In other words, that was written by someone else about Moses and therefore denies the authorship of Moses. But there's a lot of scholarship that shows that it is very highly plausible that Moses did write that about himself, and it wasn't something that denies the fact that he was meek, but it was speaking to a unique quality that the man had and describing meekness as something other than what we normally define today in our culture. Is that a hand up, Skylar? Oh, okay. You got a hand up.
It's kind of like you're talking to somebody and they might be a shy person. They say, oh, I'm shy. Does that mean they're not shy? He says he's meek. Does that mean he's not meek?
Yeah. The classic statement is meek doesn't mean weak. You can be meek without being weak, and you can still be meek and say that you're meek while at the same time you're not denying a humility or anything that would negate the idea that you were meek. Moses was a unique person. When you look at kind of, some of you might want to make this as a study as you go through the Pentateuch and the story of Moses, especially in Exodus and Numbers. Moses was one of the greatest characters of all world history. If Moses existed, and he did, and what was written about him is, he was equated, in one of the writings, he's equated with Jesus. God, in Deuteronomy, I think it's Deuteronomy 18, God said, I'm going to raise up a prophet like unto you. And he's referring to Christ, it's a messianic prophecy. And God equates for that place Moses and Christ. Now that's pretty important. And what he did as a lawgiver, I mean, even the American founding fathers recognized him. They've got a Moses put on the Supreme Court of the United States of America as a great lawgiver in world history. He's a towering figure of history, and he's a unique man in what he did. Even if you just accept him that as a historical figure and apart and kind of take out the divine, but you believe that he did what he said he did, it's an incredible story. But he was a servant of God, and he did see God on the mount, and he stands very, very tall within the story of Israel, all of Israel. And the idea that any future writer, a J-E-P-D or an R, would have ever taken any writing of Moses and tinkered with it is absurd on its face, because he stands so tall within Israelite / Jewish history. Nobody, no scribe at any time would have thought about doing that. Editing Moses, in other words. His presence, his influence, and what he was and what the scriptures say about him is so strong. If you're going to watch a movie about the Ten Commandments, watch the Cecil B. DeMille. They're a little bit closer to reality than the one that came out 3 or 4 years ago with Christian, was it Christian Bale who played Moses? That was awful. The graphics were pretty good, but they got the story really messed up. Cecil B. DeMille at least was more faithful to the biblical text, and in my generation, Charlton Heston is the epitome of Moses. They're both in color.
Well, I'm talking about there are two older ones that I.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Black and white.
The one made in the 50s by Cecil B. DeMille. Yeah. The one they play every year around Easter time.
No, I've got it.
There are a few inaccuracies there, but by and large, it's the best one of the two. Okay. Any questions about this topic? No, I didn't. What's your question? Let me quote from the Expositor's Bible Commentary. I've got this. It makes this comment. The supposition is that this verse, along with the use of the third person, is regarded as many as clear evidence of later authorship. It's possible that Moses might have offered such a line under inspiration, just as it possible that he might have recorded the account of his death. But scholars have argued that the verse began as a gloss, and then it slipped into the text. But there's no evidence for that. This particular author says, "I find myself drawn to the idea put forth by another writer that the verse should be translated miserable rather than meek." Okay. To quote, "Moses was not really an exceptionally meek man. He was a man given to rage, self-pity, questioning, and debate. He was also a man given to greatness. He's one of the most impressive figures in Bible history, certainly one of the most pivotal. But, this verse aside, it's not likely that observers of the storyline of the Pentateuch would include meekness among the character traits." He sides with the idea that the word miserable is more fitting in the context of that chapter. He's been under assault. He's found his job to be very difficult, unmanageable. He's under a great deal of pressure, and now assault comes from his own family. And so he passes beyond feeling of desperations in this lament. He's utterly speechless, a broken man. In my judgment, it should be translated with confidence in this manner. So here's how one other author translates it. "Now the man Moses was exceedingly miserable, more than any man on the face of the earth." Okay? And that's a line of thought that I think is plausible from my point of view. That's why I put this in here. I'm really quoting from notes to a member that I wrote, and they're to answer their questions about that. Okay? Any other questions? Is that a hand now, Skylar?
Yeah.
Okay.
Two, to go with it, saying if he was the meekest man, the Bible's God-breathed, so it's not like he was putting that in there just to randomly praise himself. If it was,
no.
Like, he was writing the words of God.
Yeah, he was writing under inspiration, and
yeah.
He wrote what he wrote, and should be accepted for what it is,
yeah.
Without reading into it from our point of view today that, well, that's bragging, and therefore negates what he's actually saying about himself. That's another that's a good question, and it brings up another point about looking at the Bible and all parts of the Bible from our cultural perspective today. A lot of that is done, and therefore they reject it. Why did Joshua, how can you serve a God who told Joshua to go in and kill women and children when they usurped the land, as it could be told? Well, that's writing into an ancient story plus biblical scripture from a cultural view that is very prevalent today about how nations interact, primarily how America has interacted with its own, quote, indigenous peoples. Okay? You know that phrase? You ever heard that line? You know what an indigenous people is? Native to your area, i.e. an Apache, or a Seminole, or a Cheyenne. And, white English settlers came in and moved them all to reservations and took their land. You guys have seen Walt Disney, haven't you? You've watched Pocahontas. Because they're peddling a point of view that's not exactly the way it is and what happened and the whole story. I mean, look, let's get into it since we've got two more minutes. Even with the cultural clash that's been going on in recent weeks, far-right-wing supremacists and trying to rewrite the American story about North and South, slavery, all of this. The true story, what happened and why, and understanding it in the context of the times, gets left behind. And we always need to be very, very careful how we read what is given as history or truth in any story in current events today, because there's a lot of presupposition and bias and lack of information that keeps the whole truth but from being known. So I don't want to get into the culture wars that we're involved with today necessarily, but Andrew does.
I was just going back to, is it possible that they may have, like, you know, obviously they have people that think that there was, you know, 5 different writers in the two, but, like, do you think it's possible that they might, some might believe that when it was, you know, rewritten, I believe, Ezra, they took all of the writings of it and kind of put it all into one, that they might have added that in there?
That's been put forth on Numbers 12:3, I personally don't think that's the case. I would accept that maybe the certain details about the death of Moses might have been added by a Samuel or an Ezra at a particular time, but I wouldn't personally take that on Numbers 12:3 because of what I just read from the Expositor's Bible commentary. But at that level, yes, but it's very minor and wouldn't distort the story or the truth that's being conveyed.